Please come to Busboys and Poets, 14th and V, on November 14th at 7 at 6 p.m.
I want to do a special shout out to teachers. There are many progressive teacher groups here in DC, as you probably know.
I
Teaching for
did.
Change is one that comes to mind right away. And I know teachers listen to this hour. Sometimes they listen through our archives or a podcast. Other times they're listening live if they can at 11 on a Wednesday morning. But and this hour is just a short snapshot. I have to really sing praises about your life's work. And in this book, you really make it compelling. The whole enterprise of teaching, the student and the teacher appearing to one another, of working with one another. It's very evident in this book. People need to gather the notion that you've opened up a world of poetry. You've done a pretty good job picking a variety of poets. And I just can't say enough. We are so conditioned, and this here comes the question, Bill, is coming. We're so conditioned by some sort of conventional understanding of poetry, of teaching. We all make our jokes about how we got through literature in high school, and either we were turned off from fiction or nonfiction, or we were turned on to it, or we have a wonderful retrospective perspective as an adult. Let the now be now. Enjoy teaching, enjoy living, enjoy being active for justice for people. That's why Bill Ayers is here. That's why other guests have been here. That's why we talk about race, politics, history, and culture on We the People. We need your support, listeners. You spent a lot of time about knocking down individualism, and there were many different points, and one of them was how the individualism even skews our society and structures. You talk about budgets, how we spend so much money on things that don't really help humanity. I'm going to make it open-ended. Talk about it. Why did you spend so much time on the me-ism, on the individualism part?
Well, I think that there's a dialectic in all lives between me and we. And I think we have skewered in our political life and in our culture towards an exclusive, focus on me to the detriment of the community. And I think, and you can see it in a thousand ways, income inequality, differential health outcomes, what schools you go to, educational outcomes, and so on. But I think that what's important is that if we become so individualistic, then we begin to say things like, well, public health, that means stay healthy. Public safety, own a gun. Public schools, it's a market that you have to buy into. In fact, the word public has been racialized. So when we think about public housing, public welfare, when you say public welfare, you're not talking about tax cuts to sports stadiums. You're obviously talking about the black community. So I think we have to kind of examine. You said how important words are, and I really think that's true. Thinking is the first act of resistance. But I think that we need to overcome this strict focus on the individual, and we need to understand that the community, the health of the community, is a requirement for the health of the individual. And I make the argument in teaching all the time that the greatest, that the greatest accomplishment of each individual requires the accomplishment of the whole community, and vice versa. So I'm trying to argue that we need to get over an exclusive focus on the individual and begin to think more clearly, more robustly about what's good for the community. And it's very clear from research, from common sense, that a healthy community makes individuals more healthy more of the time. And I mean healthy in the broadest sense. But you mentioned teaching and learning, and I want to just say one thing about that. I am a lifelong teacher. Most of my writing and most of my work has been in education. It's funny because if you jump into education fully, you see every other problem: war, racism, gender, everything. But my wife, who founded a center at Northwestern University Law School called the Children Family Justice Center. She says the same with the law. You jump into children's law and you make the connections. You can see everything clearly: racism, sexism, war, you know, capitalism. It all becomes clear. But I'm making an argument here. I partly draw on the freedom schools, which we talked about earlier, but I'm making an argument that we need to think about teaching, we need to think about learning much more broadly than we tend to think about it. I'm arguing away from both an individualistic idea of educational accomplishment, but also I'm arguing against a kind of a rational, testable kind of approach to teaching and learning. What I argue again and again is that the message to our students has to be, you have every right to be here. You have every right to inquire into the world. And in fact, you need no one's permission to interrogate the world. And that's a hugely important message at a time of book burning and restrictions. And, you know, here I am teaching at Stateville Prison, and I'm saying to my students, you need no one's permission to interrogate the world. You don't need mine. You don't need your parents. You don't need the warden. You have a right to interrogate the world. Otherwise, what is freedom? And the freedom to think, the freedom to learn, the freedom to teach. I'm suddenly thinking of one of your Baltimore natives, Ta-Nehisi Coates, in his first book, The Beautiful Struggle. He makes a wonderful argument about why he was made for the library and not the classroom. And what he means by that is, I want to interrogate, I want to read, I want to understand. I don't want to follow somebody else's script. In fact, I heard Ta-Nehisi speak in Chicago years ago, and one young aspiring woman who was an aspiring writer asked him, what should I read? What should my reading list be? And Coates, in form, in the tradition that he believes in, Coates said, if I gave you my reading list, it wouldn't be helpful. You have to develop your own reading list. So my advice to you is, go into the library, pick up a book and read it, and ask, what book does it now demand that I read? This is very much the way I think that we should be thinking of teaching and learning. One last point, David, is that I was very disappointed during the encampments on the colleges and the universities. Those were examples of freedom schools, the encampments for Gaza on the various campuses. And what was disappointing was watching university presidents from the most prestigious universities go in front of committees run by know-nothings and grovel, not only grovel, but be unable, apparently, to give a full-throated defense of academic freedom, meaning the freedom to teach and the freedom to learn. It's way beyond the First Amendment. Academic freedom is a sacred trust, and it means I have the freedom to teach, and you have the freedom to learn, and you have the freedom to teach. One of the great things about being a teacher is that if you teach in a certain way, you're always a student of your students. That means I never stop learning. I've learned more from my Stateville students, from my UChicago students, than I could possibly teach them. That's the beauty of the dialectic of teaching and learning.
I want to dive deeper with you on this. I think most listeners, including myself, find what you're saying very compelling. But there's a saying on the street, most people remember, not like, I'm going to add a little bit here, the facts or what you tell them, they remember how you make them feel.
That's right.
And you're certainly speaking to that. I don't want to deny that. It's so obvious. Thank you. What's perplexing is the paradox. The tell me more is, if we see the truth of what you've been just saying, why wouldn't someone behave differently? Why, under oppression, it seems like people feel like they don't have the time nor the space to really identify with other people, to really share and feel like they have a common destiny, a common existence?
Well, I think one of the things that's pretty clear is that racial capitalism foregrounds and intensifies and amplifies the individual and de-emphasizes the community. So it takes a back seat. But I think, you know, one of the things I think, David, that is very important is that you can look at the schools and deduce from schools anywhere in any point in history or any part of the world, you can deduce what the society is like. So if you looked at the schools of apartheid South Africa, you would know what apartheid is because you see small classrooms with state-of-the-art equipment for 12 white kids in a class, European kids, and a school for African kids with 60 kids in a class and a broken roof and no textbook, you know. So you can see what the society is by looking at the
That's
school.
very real, by the way. You mentioned South Africa, but I want to mention in Baltimore and Chicago, kids are freezing and having to wear jackets in their classroom.
Exactly. And so you can, or you could look at apartheid South Africa and know that the schools would look that way. The same is true for Nazi Germany or fascist Italy or medieval Saudi Arabia. If you know what the society is, you can guess what the schools are. If you look at the schools, it's important to mention fascist Germany because Nazi Germany, because they produced great intellectuals, great scientists, great athletes, some great artists, and they also produced a society that was willing to turn the other way when people were marched into the gates of hell. And so, you know, the real lessons in those German and Italian classrooms was obedience and conformity. So it makes you want to say to yourself, if obedience and conformity are what's taught in an authoritarian society, what do we teach in a free society? How do we do it? And I think too often in Baltimore and Chicago, we rely on obedience and conformity to the detriment of the arts of liberty, meaning initiative, courage, imagination. And you know, any institution in a free society would foreground initiative, courage, and courage. It would applaud imagination and creativity. Nonconformity and noncompliance would be respected, you know, and so on. But those aren't the qualities we see in too many of our schools, especially schools for the poor, schools for African-ancestored people, schools for immigrants from poor countries. These schools really rely on authoritarian precepts like obedience and conformity. That's a tragedy, and it's a tragedy we're going to pay for.
Well, talking to Bill Ayers, as you can tell, he's a very engaged teacher and also a peace and social justice activist. I imagine many of the listeners know him by reputation. And those who don't, I hope you have found this hour exciting. You're talking about when freedom is the question, abolition is the answer. And we can only do that because each and every quarter, we here at WPFW 89.3 FM ask you to make a donation, to become a member, to make a pledge today. The number is 1-800-222-9739. 1-800-222-9739. Or if you're listening on a smartphone and you have Cash App, $WPFWFM. And for those who listen across the country and in various parts of the world, and I do have those listeners, Bill, on WPFWFM.org, there's a bright red donate button. Our guest has been kind enough to make a donation. And an anonymous donor who's a new listener in Cheverly has made a donation. We still need $400 to go. Someone out there can maybe do that whole amount. Or someone out there could take a piece of that financial responsibility that keeps us on the air, keeps 80 plus programmers going, bringing you various programs. For instance, at 3 p.m., 3 to 5, Sophie's Parlor, one of the oldest women collectives on radio, brings you music and culture by women, but for everyone. Zen El Amin at 2 on Shewanana talks about the concerns of Middle Eastern affairs. And at 1 p.m., Moisa Mutale and James Pope bring you Africa Now, African descended people, not only on the continent, but throughout the diaspora, engaging governance, history, environment, political concerns, and the like. And we give you a little break each noon hour during the week. Would don't forget the blues. I'm always honored to to do the lead in for Clarence the Blues Man Turner, 12 noon Eastern Time. All that because you, the listener, choose to participate with us. We don't take that for granted. 47 years speaks to it all, folks. Be a member today. Be a sustaining member. Call 1-800-222-9739. 1-800-222-9739. Or make your donation online through WPFWFM.org, the bright red button, if you please. Thank you in advance. We really appreciate you. Bill, we've gotten to a certain juncture here, and you take on something head on in the chapter called Freedom, Anarchism, and Socialism. And that S word is such a dreaded word in the mainstream. We talk about conditioning, it really hits people's buttons. I'm just going to be direct with you. What are you trying to cover in that essay?
What I'm saying is that I'm partly saying that anarchism has gotten so is socialism, and you know when you think about it, I start that essay by talking about a visit I had in Greece with Manolis Glaisos, one of the heroes of Europe. He was 14 years old when he took the Nazi flag off the Acropolis, and he was on the run, arrested, did 10 years in prison, off and on, was tortured. But I met Manolis when he was 90 years old, and he was a marvelous guy, and I could tell you more about it, but I'll just say this, that when we were walking back to the boat that had brought me to his small island out far in the archipelago, he said to me, "You know, Bill, I think we have the same problem here in Greece that you have in the US, and that is that we get in our minds that we can't function without authority figures. We think we need a mayor and a chief of police, somebody to guide us, when actually, if we had the confidence, we can take care of our own affairs, mutual aid, solidarity, common sense." So I posit the kind of picture of the traditional picture of the anarchist in a dark, heavy overcoat running down the street with a sizzling black bomb in his arms. And I say, no, that's a funny image, but it's not real. What's real is think about a large, slightly off-kilter family, or think about a large, lovely daycare center. It's filled with errors and mistakes and stupidities and so on. But somehow we take care of each other. Somehow we look to each other to solve problems. And I think that that's the kind of way I want to think about it. The other piece, socialism, I argue in the essay that freedom without socialism is predation and exploitation, but socialism without freedom is slavery and captivity. You know, you need somehow this balance, but socialism means simply that we identify what is in our collective goodwill and we push the collective efforts and resources to solve those problems. Obviously, highways are socialist. I always argue with my right-wing friends and so on, that they rode the socialist highway up to get to the meeting, you know, because you don't pay a toll on the local streets. It's just, we agreed.
At least for a little while, unless you're, I'm thinking of a certain southern state where you pay a toll every few minutes then.
Privatize everything. Let's remember, garbage pickup in Chicago is a socialist enterprise. And frankly, I don't want it private. I don't want you to decide whether your garbage should be picked up. I want us to agree that all the garbage should be picked up. That's the kind of thing. And so, if it's true for garbage and it's true for streets, why can't it be true for a robust rail system? Why can't it be true for healthcare? Why can't it be true for education? Education, part of the reason the right wing hates education, public schools, is because they're public, because they're paid for by the public. Now, with all the flaws, you know, this poor community doesn't, because it's based on property tax, doesn't get the resources that this rich community gets. And that's telling about the society we live in. But the important thing is, we should have public schools. It should be a human right that every kid, by dint of being born, has access to a forward-looking, fully resourced education within reach, not that he has to reach for in some way, but one you can walk to. That's a socialist kind of ideal.
Well, this hour's been full, and like when I saw you in Baltimore, people know that They project at you that you have some secret sauce, pardon me, pardon my accent, about organizing. And within a week's time, to be kind of cheesy and dramatic, the fate of the world could easily change given a certain election. A word about organizing and moving forward. We have about less than 2 to 3 minutes, really.
Well,
Unfair, I know. I'm sorry.
the election question, and part of what I'm doing on this book tour is going to the youth communities, independent bookstores, mostly in swing states. I think it's very important that folks vote. I understand all the reasons not to vote. But I can hold in my mind two contradictory ideas. The lesser of two evils is still evil, and the lesser of two evils is still lesser. So the question about voting and organizing, I feel like organizing is very much like teaching. You knock on a door, you assume the person who answers that door is a full human being. You learn from that person as well as teach that person. And you try to build within that a sense of community and a sense of common purpose. But we can organize 365 days a year. I can be an activist 365 days a year. It takes me 15 minutes to vote. And the reason I think it's important, I mean, there are many reasons, and I know all the reasons not to vote. But I think the reason to vote is because it's not a moral issue, it's a practical issue. It's not a Valentine, it's a test group. It's not voting for your friend, it's voting for your next opponent. And so I can vote, and I can vote for the lesser of two evils. And a good example of why one should do that is the Dobbs decision. Dobbs, you can say it's Tweedledum and Tweedledumber, it is. There's only an inch between the two bourgeois parties. That's true. But that a lot of important people, vulnerable people, live within that inch. And so I'm going to vote. I worked with people arm to arm, with people who died for the right to vote, Goodman, Shorter, Cheney, SNCC. I also know all over the world, people are literally dying to vote. I'm going to vote. I also know the ways in which it's phony and inadequate, but I'm going to do it because people die for it, because it's a blood debt, because it will make a difference. Small as that difference is, get right out the next day after you vote and organize. Organize an irresistible social movement to bring about the real changes that we need in this country and in this world.
Bill Ayres, thank you. Time well spent. Every moment. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, David. I appreciate you very much.
My thanks to the listeners for sticking with us in this hour, for continuing to support WPFW for more than 47 years. The show's coming to an end. We have $300 to go. Someone or someones, as in many, can make that difference. Won't you please become a member today by calling 1-800 222-9739. 1-800-222-9739. We need you. I need you. The station needs you. And we need to continue jazz and justice beyond our 47 years. Become a member today. And I thank you. My thanks to Mike Nasella, our engineer, and to the News and Public Affairs Department of WPFW. To the other programmers who work so hard, who give you both joy and truth, thank you. And listeners, thank you. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for spreading the word and telling others. Again, you can still continue to donate even as the show is finishing up, as the news is about to come on, and then Clarence the Blues Man Turner will join you with the blues. Have a great day, and again, thank you for being with us. Take good care.
through our tears. More lawmakers cry.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. Vice President Kamala Harris made her closing argument for president last night and warned rival Donald Trump is a threat to democracy in a speech from the Ellipse, where Trump incited his supporters on January 6, 2021, to violently attack the U.S. Capitol and stop certification of Joe Biden's electoral win.
America, this is not a candidate for president who is thinking about how to make your life better. This is someone who is unstable, obsessed with revenge, consumed with grievance, and out for unchecked power.
She warned Trump will enact a personal agenda if he gets back to the Oval Office and vowed to fight for the American people.
Those who came before us, the Patriots at Normandy and Selma, Seneca Falls and Stonewall, on farmlands and factory floors. They did not struggle, sacrifice, and lay down their lives only to see us cede our fundamental freedoms. They didn't do that only to see us submit to the will of another petty tyrant.
Trump Tuesday defiantly praised his Sunday rally at Madison Square Gardens, calling it a love fest. It's been likened to a Nazi rally nearly a century ago at the Garden. Sunday, Trump reiterated xenophobic rhetoric, and comedian Tony Hinchcliffe called Puerto Rico a floating island of garbage.
Can you imagine that? 1939, the Nazi, they were. But how terrible to say, right? Because, you know, they've used Madison Square Garden many times. Many people have used it, but nobody's ever had a crowd like that. And I tell you what, right now, nobody's ever had love like that. That was love in the room, and it was love for our country.
The rally also included misogynistic comments against Harris and disparaging remarks against Blacks, Jews, Latinos, and Palestinians. The man who broke into then-House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's home and attacked her husband with a hammer, fracturing his skull, was sentenced to life in prison Tuesday. 44-year-old David DePape was sentenced to 30 years in federal prison earlier this year. Yesterday, he was sentenced on state charges, including false imprisonment of an elder, threatening the life of a family member, of a public official, and dissuading a witness by force or threat. A jury found DePape guilty in June. His attack fueled by right-wing conspiracy theories about Pelosi and other Democrats. The United Nations is warning Israel's new law to block UNRWA from operating in Gaza and other Palestinian territories will lead to more needless deaths. Palestinians in Gaza say it's a death sentence. Rami Almagari reports from the Gaza Strip.
The 18-member family of 73-year-old Mahmoud Elbar is one of dozens of thousands of refugee households in Gaza. Mahmoud has relied on UNRWA-provided services for the whole of his life. Mahmoud is worried about the future of those services.
We don't own a farm, we don't have a job or nothing. The UNRWA is the only body that ensures medicines, food, and education for me, for my sons, and my grandchildren.
The Palestinian Authority in Ramallah considers the Knesset's vote as an Israeli attempt to eliminate the Palestinian cause, since UNRWA stands as a witness to the refugees' problem. Dr. Adel Mansour is director of the Gaza Strip Southern Governorate within the Palestine Liberation Organization's Refugees Department.
The Israeli occupiers of the land impose resolutions by force. Their war of genocide and crimes in the Gaza Strip and the Northern West Bank and all other refugee camps impact the life of the Palestinian people and the future of the Palestinian cause.
For Pacifica Radio, KPFA, I am Rami Almighari.